I want to make sure that we can hear everyone. Mr. Nelson, can you please speak so we can hear you?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Thank you. And then Mr. Lundy, if you could turn your mute button off so we can make can you say something, please?
Yes. Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning. We can hear you. Can both of the attorneys hear everyone?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, then Madam Marshal, would you please call the case?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Werke, Judge Bratfold, the Honorable Denise Riley presiding. Now calling the case of State versus Meyer, A19-2020.
And have either of you been present through a Zoom hearing?
I have not, Your Honor. I've just done an ITV before.
Okay. And Mr. Lundy, you're a student, so presumably this may be your first time. Is that right?
At least arguing in front of this court, yes, Your Honor, this is my first time.
Well, welcome to both of you. You each will have 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Nelson, if you choose to use it. And the marshal will have a clock up so that you can see your time. Please be mindful of that. And state your name at the beginning of each of your arguments because this is being recorded. So with that, appellant's attorney may start.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Andrew Nelson, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Nathan Meyer. This court must reverse Nathan Meyer's conviction for second-degree assault against AB because the evidence is insufficient to support a finding of substantial bodily harm. Minnesota Statute 609.027A defines substantial bodily harm as an injury which involves either.
Excuse me, Mr. Nelson, before you start in substantial bodily harm, I just want to make sure because I didn't see it, but we want to flesh out all of the issues that may come up. You're agreeing that he did possess a dangerous weapon. That isn't before us. We don't need to worry about that. That's not an issue, correct?
Appellant's brief does not argue that a knife
All right,
is not
so we're only talking the second element, and that's the substantial bodily harm. I just want to make sure. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. But under that statute, substantial bodily harm is defined as one of three injuries, and that is either a temporary but substantial disfigurement, a temporary but substantial loss of function of a bodily member, or a fracture of any bone. AB, the victim in this case, did not suffer a fracture. And the state failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the 2-inch cut to his upper left arm constituted a substantial disfigurement or a substantial loss of function. And I would like to begin by addressing loss of function.
Mr. Nelson, you are not contesting the jury instructions that the judge gave to the jury when they were considering the evidence, right?
No, Your Honor. Is there a specific jury instruction you're concerned with?
No, I'm just saying that you aren't saying that the judge incorrectly instructed the jury on what they were supposed to look at with regard to the facts and the law.
No, Your Honor, I'm not. At trial, the state called 12 witnesses, and that included the 5 officers, 3 eyewitnesses, the 2 victims, J.A. and A.B., an agent from the BCA, and a registered nurse, Kristen Altermat. Of those 12 witnesses, none of the witnesses testified that AB had any loss of function in his arm or that he had any substantial inability to move his arm.
Well, you're acknowledging that at least it was described as the length and the diameter and the fact that it involved his tricep muscles. You're acknowledging that the jury did hear that testimony.
Yes, Your Honor, they did hear that testimony.
And the jury heard the testimony that there were stitches that had to be applied in order to close AB's wound, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So if the jury makes a decision as to whether that rises to a level of substantial bodily harm, how do we substitute our decision for that of the jury?
Your Honor, I'm not asking this court to substitute its discretion for that of the jury. Rather, what this court needs to do is look and see if the jury had sufficient evidence to reach the conclusion they did. And today I'm arguing that they did not have essentially any.
You just acknowledged that the evidence that I reiterated, and that's not all of the evidence, was presented and heard by the jury. So if you're saying that the evidence is lacking, are you going towards what about the disfigurement element? Wouldn't stitches cause a disfigurement?
Your Honor, allow me to address your first question, and then I'll get to the disfigurement right away. When you talk about the dimensions, you're correct. The jury heard the dimensions. They heard that it was 6 centimeters long and 3 centimeters wide, which is essentially, I believe the state says, 2.3 inches and 1.2 inches. The jury also heard testimony in the form of both Kristen Altermat's testimony and the medical report, which was entered into evidence, that cut involved the triceps muscle, as Your Honor just stated, but that triceps muscle would heal with a limited loss of function, which I am arguing a limited loss of function does not establish a substantial loss of function as required under the statute. Now, to get to Your Honor's question about disfigurement, although unavailing, I believe disfigurement is the state's best argument here today. But on the issue of disfigurement, out of those 12 witnesses that I mentioned, only 3 of the witnesses testified that they actually saw AB's injury. And that included Jonathan Mertens, the officer who applied the tourniquet, arguably AB saw his own injuries, and then Kristen Altermat, who treated the injuries. But when we view all of their testimony in a light most favorable to the jury's verdict, which is what this court should do in this case, the state established the dimensions of the wound, that it was 2 inches long, that it was sealed with stitches, that it would heal with a minimal loss of function, that the wound was not a minor injury, and that the medical report described this injury as a moderate injury, not a substantial injury, a moderate injury. And so to answer Your Honor's question, that evidence rebuts the state's argument that this was a substantial disfigurement or a substantial loss of function.
The jury also saw the pictures, and there was a lot of blood when I looked at those pictures.
Yes, Your Honor.
And do you think that might have factored into their finding?
Your Honor, I can't speculate whether that would have factored in. I would guess that it would factor into their finding. But I would argue to this court that blood loss on its own isn't even evidence of a substantial disfigurement or a substantial loss of function. I can think of 2 circumstances where it may be. The first is if a witness or if a victim lost so much blood that they lost consciousness, then that blood loss might be evidence of a loss of function, because this court has held that unconsciousness is a loss of function. Or if a victim suffered a compound fracture where the bone came out of the skin, then blood might be evidence of that fracture. But here, we can think of circumstances like a bloody nose, where you can bleed all over your shirt without having any injury. So I don't believe that blood loss on its own is evidence of either the loss of function or the disfigurement. And I would also like to address Judge Riley's question about the pictures. In this case, I would ask this court to compare the pictures entered of AB's injury to the pictures entered of JA's injury. In this case, the state offered 6 pictures of JA's injury. That included 3 pictures, exhibits 3 through 5, of the patching, the bandages on JA's back. Exhibits 6 and 7 were of the hole in JA's back. And exhibit number 8 was of a zoomed up picture of the wound that was so close you could almost see inside of JA's body. And that evidence was enough to give to the jury. And then the jury had enough to reach a conclusion that that was substantial bodily harm. When we compare that to...
Well, you're not contesting that his injuries didn't rise, that there's insufficient evidence for his injuries.
No, Your Honor, we are not.
I mean, he was airlifted to Hennepin County Medical Center with life-threatening injuries.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
But the comparison I'd like this court to compare is then AB. AB had 1 picture entered of his injury, and the officer who took that picture testified that you can't even see the injury, that the injury is located beneath the tourniquet. And when AB testified he had a scar, but there was no evidence that he showed the jury the scar, showed the jury where the scar was located. Was it on the back of his arm? Was it towards his armpit where it could still hit his tricep?
As I recall AB's testimony, he couldn't remember anything.
Yes, Your Honor.
He was intoxicated.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. But when I talk about the scar on the stand, at that time, he would have known where his scar was. And so I'm arguing that he never showed the jury his scar. The state never asked him to show the jury or describe the scar. And while we talk about this issue of the scar, I do want to address the state's argument, and the state is correct, that a scar isn't necessary. This statute only requires temporary disfigurement. But what a scar can show is a scar can show the location of an injury, the visibility of an injury. And when I look at all the case law dealing with this issue of substantial bodily harm, there are really only three ways the state can prove substantial disfigurement. And that's either through a scar, pictures of the injury, or testimony about the injury. And here, the state was lacking all three. The jury never got to see the scar or hear testimony about the scar. They never got to see the injury or hear testimony about the injury. And in terms of testimony, the only testimony we have were the dimensions of the wound, that it was 2 inches, that it would heal with a minimal loss of function, and that it was of moderate severity and closed with stitches. And this court, in other cases such as Anderson, has held that a scar running from a victim's pelvis all the way to their chest constituted serious permanent disfigurement under the first degree statute. And with an injury that severe, maybe the description or the diameter of the injury is enough, but I would submit to this court that a 2-inch scar on a victim's upper left arm isn't sufficient when we don't know where it was, what it looked like, and the jury didn't know where it was or what it looked like. If this court doesn't have any further questions, I'd like to just briefly address appellant's remand argument.
So, counsel, I'd like you to address the use of the tourniquet to stop the blood as a temporary loss of function.
Your Honor, is your question whether applying that tourniquet was evidence for the jury to consider that he couldn't use his arm, essentially?
Right.
Your Honor, the state argues that in their brief, that while that wound was open, while that tourniquet was on, his arm was essentially worthless. I believe the state argues that he couldn't write with his arm, he couldn't drink, go bowling, or play mini golf. But the jury never heard any testimony about whether AB could use his arm. As Judge Riley pointed out, AB didn't remember anything about that night. So AB wasn't gonna be able to provide that testimony. But no witnesses out of those 12 testified, you know, AB was holding his arm and he couldn't move it. Jonathan Mertens, the officer.
Counsel, you seem to be missing the jury's ability to make inferences based on the evidence.
Your Honor, I agree the jury can make inferences, but I'm arguing that the state needed to present some evidence that he had some inability to move
it. Isn't the tourniquet that evidence? That's my question. So, I mean, why is a tourniquet used if it's not used to stop the blood flow and reestablish use of the arm?
Your Honor, you are correct. The tourniquet is used to stop the blood loss, but I would argue that blood loss is an evidence of a loss of function of the arm without testimony that it caused a loss of function of his arm. Did that answer Your Honor's question?
Thanks, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. The last thing I'd like you to do is point out a case in Minnesota where we've ruled in your favor on this issue with a similar analysis, or at least which one you think is the closest. Thanks.
Your Honor, on this issue, cases are of limited guidance. Because a finding of substantial bodily harm or substantial disfigurement, substantial loss of function, necessarily depends on the victim's specific injuries and their effect on that victim's appearance or bodily function. Appellant cites the cases Harlan and Carlson, I believe, for the proposition of this kind of comparison. But I would argue this court can't really compare these injuries to other injuries, because in order to meet this statute, the state had to prove that it met one of three injuries, not that it was more or less severe than the injuries in another case.
Well, in Harlan, there were stitches, and here there's stitches. So I don't, how do you differentiate the issue, the facts of your case, Mr. Nelson, with the holding in Harlan?
Well, Your Honor, in Harlan, we had a lot more than stitches. We had a victim who testified that she couldn't dress herself. She couldn't lie down in her bed without help, that she missed 3 weeks of work, that she had permanent discoloration all over her back. And so I would argue in that case, the stitches, although this isn't stated in the holding, the stitches were of least concern. The biggest part of her testimony was that she couldn't dress herself, she couldn't lie down, and that established requisite elements for substantial bodily harm. One thing I'd also like to point to this court's attention is when we look at the first degree statute has a catch-all. It has three injuries and then or any other severe bodily injury. And had the second degree statute had some kind of catch-all like that, this court could consider the blood loss, could consider those other factors that the jury can look at. But unless the state was able to prove that this case fell into one of the three injuries outlined under the second degree statute, the state didn't prove their case. And this court shouldn't uphold the jury's verdict. With my last minute, I'd like to just briefly address appellant's remand argument. In appellant's brief, appellant argues that this court should remand this case, should reverse appellant's conviction for second degree assault against AB and remand and enter conviction on the fifth degree. The state cites Uber for the proposition that this court can meet halfway, that under 2802.12c, this court can reduce this to a lesser included, as the case may require. But I am unaware of any case where this court has remanded to a lesser included that wasn't charged, where there is a lesser included that has been charged. So I would argue to this court that that language, as the case may require, requires this court to impose the fifth degree, because the state charged the fifth degree, the state proved the fifth degree, and this court doesn't need to find a different lesser included to sentence on. And with that, I will conclude by just asking this court to reverse appellant's conviction for second degree assault. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Respondent?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Will Lundy, and I am a law student practitioner, and I represent respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. Because the jury could reasonably conclude that a stab wound 6 centimeters long by 3 centimeters wide by 3 centimeters deep constituted a substantial deformity and that it substantially impaired the victim's use of his arm, respondent respectfully asked this court to affirm appellant's conviction of second degree assault with a dangerous weapon resulting in substantial bodily harm. And even if this court concludes that the evidence was insufficient to establish that the victim suffered substantial bodily harm, because the state necessarily charged and the jury necessarily found respondent guilty of every element of second degree assault with a dangerous weapon, respondent respectfully asks this court to remand the case to the district court with instructions to resentence appellant on the lesser included offense of second degree assault with a dangerous weapon. Again, and that's in the event that this court should disagree or should agree with appellant rather that that the evidence was insufficient to establish substantial bodily harm. But the evidence was sufficient to prove substantial bodily harm. As appellant noted, substantial bodily harm is a temporary but substantial disfigurement or a temporary but substantial impairment of function. And appellant is correct that a fracture is also substantial bodily harm, but I am making no argument that that appellant suffered any kind of fracture in this case. Under that definition of substantial bodily harm, the state does not need to prove or show any permanent or protracted disfigurement or loss of function. So, and for that reason, this is why a scar is likely to be irrelevant with regard to the question of whether or not there was a substantial temporary disfigurement. The jury did hear evidence that, again, that the wound was 6 centimeters long by 3 centimeters wide by 3 centimeters deep, and that it required 6 stitches. There's ample evidence that the wound was bleeding profusely, both in the testimony and in the photographs. And the jury is permitted to conclude that such an injury constitutes a substantial disfigurement. There can really be no question that the arm was disfigured by the stab wound. It didn't look like his arm looked before he was stabbed. In fact, there would have been blood everywhere, again, as evidenced by the photographs. This isn't an injury that a person would simply walk around with in public. People would be shocked to see a person walking around with this kind of an injury and bleeding all over the place. So, and it was within the jury's province to conclude that this constituted a substantial disfigurement. Whether or not an injury constitutes substantial bodily harm is a question of fact. It's a question for the jury to decide. And therefore, it as as someone pointed out, it is not for this court to substitute its judgment for the judgment of the jury when it comes to that question. Additionally, when it comes to whether or not there was substantial loss of the function in appellant's arm, Judge Bratwold, I believe you pointed out that with the tourniquet, the jury was permitted to infer that appellant did lose substantial function in his arm. And again, I would submit that with the nature of this injury, a wound of that size, we're talking about 54 cubic centimeters of displaced flesh, or approximately 3.3 cubic inches of displaced flesh. That's a large injury, and the jury is permitted to infer that with that kind of a stab wound, that the appellant would not have been able to use his arm in the way that he would otherwise. With that kind of a bleeding injury, he certainly couldn't go bowling or use his arm for many of the purposes that a person would typically use his arm for. So, for that reason, the evidence is sufficient to establish that appellant lost substantial function or there was a substantial impairment of the function of his arm. And accordingly, the evidence was sufficient to prove that appellant caused a substantial bodily harm that appellant caused substantial bodily harm to the victim by stabbing him in the back of the arm. As far as other cases that appellant cites to, I have to agree with what appellant said that frequently with cases like this, the case law isn't particularly instructive. And the reason for that is, you know, this court looks to see, well, is this evidence sufficient to find a particular kind of injury? And as appellant pointed out, the jury was correct to find that J.A.'s injuries constituted substantial bodily harm. And in many of the cases that appellant cites, this court or the Supreme Court found that the evidence was sufficient to establish substantial bodily harm. But to draw the next conclusion that those kinds of injuries are also necessary to constitute substantial bodily harm, that conclusion is a logical fallacy. And the Supreme Court recently dealt with exactly this kind of fallacy in State versus DeGroat, where it talked about whether or not a substantial step was taken in an attempt crime. And the appellant there argued similarly that here are these cases that demonstrate what is necessary for a substantial step. But really what those cases were talking about is what was sufficient to establish a substantial step, not what it is necessary. And the same is true here. It was for the jury to decide whether or not the injury that AB sustained and that appellant caused constituted a substantial disfigurement.
So counsel, I'd like you to identify which case you think is most similar to the one before us. I appreciate both of the arguments that the appellant and respondent have made with respect to case law. You're certainly right from a legal standpoint, but we still look at case law for guidance. So which do you think we should look at to compare the evidence in this case?
Compare the evidence in this case. I would say, goodness, off the top of my head, Your Honor, I don't really have a case that I would point to and say, you know, this is the case that I think is closest here. There was a case that I mentioned in my brief. I don't remember exactly the name of it off the top of my head right now, but in that case, the victim suffered a black eye and he suffered, I think, a bloody nose and some other kinds of injuries. That case was, you know, was at least opposite to this one because there was no fracture and there was no evidence of, of great bodily harm. And some of the cases that appellant cited too, I remember they there was some kind of a serious permanent injury, things that would have probably been sufficient for even great bodily harm. So they exceeded the substantial bodily harm standard. Whereas the case that I mentioned with the black eyes, and it was, you know, again, it was an assault case. I believe it's State versus Carlson is the case that I'm talking about. And, so if we were to compare those injuries and say, well, is a black eye or a bloody nose, if that's substantial bodily harm, well, what about a stab wound on the back of the arm? who's to say which one of those is a more serious disfigurement? And I would suggest that the person to say that would be the jury. And that's what juries, again, that's what juries do. That's why we have juries, is to make those kinds of determinations. And it's a common sense question. Is this a substantial disfigurement? And the jury has the sole authority to make that call. If this court doesn't have any further questions on the nature of the injury here, or whether or not the victim suffered substantial bodily harm, I do want to address just briefly the remand argument. I'd like to point out, first of all, that appellant made absolutely no argument in the argument section of his brief as to why this court should remand this case with instructions to convict the appellant and then to sentence the appellant on fifth degree assault rather than second degree assault with a dangerous weapon. And now appellant in his reply brief has argued that while this court may reduce a conviction to an uncharged lesser included offense, as long as the state didn't explicitly charge any lesser included offenses, that this court must not reduce a conviction to an uncharged lesser included offense if the state charges both a greater offense and a different lesser included offense. Again, that argument was not made in the argument section of his brief. And I would submit that argument, because it's an extension of the law, at least, is waived. There's no support in the case law for that proposition. There's no support for it in the language of the various lesser included offense statutes. So for example, section 60904, says that the actor, upon prosecution for a crime, the actor may be convicted of either the crime charged or an included offense, which is to say, if he can be convicted of either the crime charged or an included offense, section 60904 necessarily envisions an uncharged included offense. And this court has done exactly that in State versus Carpenter and in State versus Uber. This court reduced convictions from in State versus Carpenter, it was a first degree sale of a controlled substance. The defendant asked this court to reduce to a lesser included offense that was not charged. And this court reduced the conviction to an uncharged second degree sale of a controlled substance. And in State versus Uber, the defendant didn't ask to be convicted of a lesser included offense upon the insufficiency of the evidence, but this court nonetheless reduced an aggravated DWI conviction to an uncharged lesser included offense of misdemeanor DWI. The Minnesota Supreme Court has held that a defendant may be found guilty of any offense, the commission of which is necessarily included in that with which he is charged in the indictment. And second degree assault with a dangerous weapon is indisputably necessarily included within second degree assault with a dangerous weapon plus substantial bodily harm. Again, appellant has made no argument that the knife that he used to stab AB was not a dangerous weapon. That argument has been waived. It was never made in the briefs. And again, there were two victims here. So if appellant wanted to challenge the nature of the weapon, as far as whether or not it was a dangerous weapon, he would have had to have argued that the evidence was insufficient to establish that that he committed second degree assault with a dangerous weapon against JA, and he has not made that argument. Essentially, what appellant is asking this court to do is reverse his conviction and find him guilty only of the lesser included offense of fifth degree assault, despite not arguing anything about the element of the dangerous weapon, and despite the fact that the jury heard jury instructions about dangerous weapon, it heard jury instructions about assault, and it found that appellant was using a dangerous weapon. So in order to reverse the conviction here and resentence for fifth degree assault, would ignore the jury's determination that appellant committed each and every element of second degree assault with a dangerous weapon. If this court has no further questions, I have nothing further to argue.
Thank you, Mr. Lundy. You did a admirable job on your first go in the Court of Appeals. So congratulations.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to begin rebuttal by readdressing or taking a second stab at Judge Bradfold's question. And I would agree with opposing counsel here that Carlson, as far as what's cited in the briefs, Carlson's the most opposite case here. But I would disagree with opposing counsel that, like Carlson, the jury here had evidence to make a common sense decision. In Carlson, and this is directly quoted from Carlson, the court states Sherry's testimony, the doctor's testimony, and the photographs taken of her injuries were enough to allow the jury to reach that verdict. And when we look at this case, there was almost no testimony. There was no testimony from the victim. There were no pictures of the injury. And unlike Carlson, the jury here did not have enough evidence to make a common sense decision about AB's injuries. I'd also like to address opposing counsel's argument about the 3.3 cubic inches of destroyed flesh. Once again, that's testimony that perhaps could have assisted the jury in reaching this conclusion, but that's not testimony the jury heard. The state also argues that a scar is irrelevant, but a scar is not.
Except, Mr. Nelson, the jury did have the medical records.
Yes, Your Honor, and unless I missed it, I don't believe that cubic inches of destroyed flesh is in the medical records. They had the diameter and the width.
So they could do the depth.
Yeah, so they could have done the math in the jury room, I guess. But I also want to address the opposing counsel's argument that a scar is irrelevant. This court and other cases, primarily dealing with first degree, such as McDaniel and Gerald, have held that the location and the visibility of an injury matter. In Safety McDaniel, this court held that a highly visible scar on a victim's upper neck constituted serious permanent disfigurement. And the reason why a scar is important is because opposing counsel points out that this is not a wound that could go unnoticed. But depending on where this injury is located on his arm, it could have gone unnoticed. And that's something the state did not prove at trial. Finally, I just want to briefly address opposing counsel's argument about remand in this case.
So counsel, just to follow up quickly, you're saying this is a wound that could have gone unnoticed after it healed.
Your Honor,
right? Not at the time it happened, from everything I've read.
Your Honor, I'm arguing that at the time it happened, the state didn't prove where this was, how big it was. Well, how big it was, yes. What it looked like, the state didn't prove this could have gone or that this couldn't go unnoticed.
You mean, are you arguing that it's not even clear he needed medical treatment? I'm very confused. I'm sorry.
Your Honor, it is very clear that he needed medical
treatment. Okay. All right. Then I think I understand your point.
Well, and the blood was noticeable and required a tourniquet.
Yes, Your Honor, but I would argue that anything that can be wiped off with a rag does not constitute a serious or a substantial disfigurement.
Well, a tourniquet is a little bit different than a rag.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't catch that.
I said a tourniquet's a little different than a rag. Because a tourniquet helps to staunch the bleeding.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Did the jury hear evidence from an RN nurse that it was not a minor wound? I mean, that was an opinion of a medical professional. Would that not be sufficient to allow the jury to adopt that testimony and conclude that it was not a minor wound?
Your Honor, opposing counsel makes that exact argument in their brief, that the testimony that it was not a minor wound establishes that it was a substantial wound, but that's not correct. Injuries run on a spectrum. And we can see in the medical report that the doctor who performed the examination said that this injury was of moderate severity, meaning average, meaning not substantial severity. So I would argue that minor testimony doesn't establish substantial disfigurement. With the last minute I have here, I just want to briefly address opposing counsel's argument about Carpenter. Opposing counsel cites Carpenter and Uber for the argument that this court should remand, if they remand, and sentence on the first subdivision of the second degree statute. But in Carpenter, this court did not have another conviction that they could enter on. In Carpenter, once the first degree convictions were reversed, there was nothing. So it was either acquit the defendant or find the lesser included. Here, the court is not faced with that same choice. And here, the case does not require this court to find a conviction that wasn't charged by the state. I believe that implicates some elements of fundamental fairness here. I see that my time is up. I'll just ask this court to reverse appellant's conviction for second degree assault. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. And thank you, Mr. Lundy. The case was well briefed and well argued, and we will have our decision out within the 90 days.